Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
There is probably no better measure of how well a society works or how humane it truly is than how well it educates its children. And we're going to be discussing that tonight with Kyle Olson, who is very much concerned with the issue of how American schools are functioning these days, how they're funded, how they're organized, and what they are teaching and how they're doing that. He is the founder and the CEO of an outfit called Education Action Group Foundation, which is a nonpartisan and nonprofit organization whose stated goal is to promote sensible education reform and to expose those with a vested interest in maintaining the status quo. I'm reading from their literature. That's how they describe themselves. I offer you, Kyle, as we open, two classical quotations. That's always a good way to give a little panache and dignity to the conversation about to begin. Aristotle says, "It is the mark of an educated mind to be able to entertain a thought without accepting it." Diogenes Laertius says, "The foundation of every state is the education of its youth." We're offering a lot of ideas to our kids these days, according to what you say in your new book, Indoctrination. A lot of ideas, a lot of characterizations, a lot of, quote, information, which pushes them to entertain thoughts that you feel they ought to be rejecting.
Well, and I think it is important for students to get a broad variety of opinions in a classroom and then consider those opinions and then form their own opinion. But oftentimes what they get in American classrooms is a biased opinion, a personal political opinion of a teacher, and then they're forced to essentially regurgitate that back to the teacher.
How does the one item with which I started tonight, which I get from your book, Indoctrination, that rewrite of the Pledge of Allegiance, how does that illustrate that?
Well, I think there's a movement towards moving students away from being Americans and towards being global citizens. And so what you've got in that pledge is a perfect example. There is a line of thinking that America is to blame for all of the ills of society, not only here but around the world. Our free markets are to blame. We're to blame for third world poverty and all of those sorts of things. And what we as a society need to be doing, or as a country, is we need to be redistributing our wealth around the world, and that will somehow fix things. Unfortunately, that is the line of thinking, and that's why you get these types of pledges of becoming global citizens or pledging to the earth and those sorts of things.
And that is being prosecuted and pushed in our schools by many people in many different ways, you assert.
Absolutely.
Give me the broader picture. What's going on?
Well, what's happening is you've got – and again, this is not every single teacher. This is not every school. But that being said, many people who go into education believe it is their duty and their right to change American culture, to change the way America currently exists. I mean, a great example of this is Bill Ayers, who lives right here in Chicago.
Well-known figure in Chicago life, though lots of people don't know what they should know about him.
That's right. People got to know him in 2008 and 2007 with his connection to President Obama, his connection to Weather Underground and those sorts of things. But what people don't know is his very powerful influence on the public education system, literally how teachers are taught and then the impact that those teachers have on children.
When he got off from the possibility of federal prosecution for the revolutionary efforts that he was involved with as one of the leaders of the Weathermen, one of the founders of the Weathermen, as I remember it, and went on a technicality, though his wife was prosecuted and sent to jail for a while, sent to prison for a while, he was not. And then he started a new career. I guess he went to graduate school someplace or other and got a degree in education. And he wound up a professor of education.
That's right.
At the University of Illinois, Chicago.
Correct.
Where he's been for lo these many years, running a program and exerting influence that lots of ordinary people, including ordinary parents who are concerned about what sort of education their kids are going to get, so they don't know anything about the influence and the content of the preachment to other teachers by Ayers himself.
That's right. He has had a huge influence on curriculum studies, and literally how teachers teach. And he's been very influential in this regard. And so he has authored textbooks, which then students that are in colleges of education read. And then obviously that shapes the way that they become teachers. And so he and Mike Klonsky is another one.
He's a close associate of Ayers.
That's correct.
Also at UIC.
Correct. There are several. There's a core, I think, of far-left radicals that have had a huge influence on our education system.
I would imagine Jonathan Osler is an associate of theirs as well. You quote Osler in your book, Indoctrination, who is the author of something titled Guide for Integrating Issues of Social and Economic Justice into the Mathematics Curriculum.
That's right.
We might take a look at that as we continue, right after we pause, to render our service to capitalism for a few minutes, and then directly back to Kyle Olson, drawing from his new book, Indoctrination.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
So let's look at how this mentality, whatever one, it's far left, it's contemptuous of much that is received as virtuous and lasting and of significance in defining our values and our very stance as a historic society. I don't know what single word to use to characterize this group, but they're left. They're very left in orientation. They show up in many different sectors of American professional life, and there are loads and loads of people of that disposition now in American public education. And we've just focused for a moment on mathematics. You've named two people, Klonsky. You've named two people, Ayers and Klonsky. I added Jonathan Osler, whom I learned about from your book. Tell me how you do mathematics in a way that that pushes kids into understanding what a menacing and unsatisfying business the United States has been.
Well, when I went to school, we learned about how many dimes are in a dollar, or if I work 2 hours or two miles from my home and I'm driving 30 miles an hour, how long does it take me to get there? I mean, math that you would use, you know, in everyday life. But I think the progressives in education have seen this medium to get out their agenda. And so you talk about social justice math. And actually, there was just an example from Georgia just a couple days ago where some of the questions dealt with slavery. And the questions were, you know, how many dealt with, you know, beating slaves and picking oranges and all of these types of things. And so what the purpose is to push this personal philosophy. I mean, another great example is in the book I talk about one of the things that they want students to calculate is if I'm a minority, what are the chances that I will be pulled over by the police if I'm driving a car? It's those types of things that I believe they're trying to divide society. They're trying to push this personal political agenda. And so we've moved beyond just simply preparing kids for life. And I think we're moving into this phase where there are people like Ayers, people like Klonsky, who feel that the public school, the government school, is their medium to change culture.
Yet, now, to take a position somewhat resistant to what you're saying, whether I'm role-playing or not, somebody might well say in response to the particular example you've just given, how many, through a math exercise, you're really turning kids' attention to the fact that blacks are pulled over by cops in disproportionately larger number than are whites. That happens to be true, I think. And therefore, a proper riposte to you would be, that's an unhappy social fact about our existence. You don't want us to completely ignore injustice as it shows up in our own society.
No, absolutely not. But the trouble is that, and I get into this in the book, is that these types of issues are being pushed on kids at younger and younger ages. So they don't understand these issues. And I'm not attempting to dismiss, you know, what you're talking about. But kids don't understand the context. They don't understand these sorts of issues. And so what they're trying to do, I believe, is get to kids at younger and younger ages where they're more impressionable. And push these types of things. So as they get older, as they get into high school or college or whatever the case may be, they're fitting more to this liking. And I just I think it's a very dangerous direction that our public education system is going, and parents need to be aware of it. And so I think, you know, the other argument is that look at if our system was doing great, you know, if graduation rates were good, if test scores were good, if students were really doing well, then there would be room for these sorts of things. But the trouble is, I mean, you take Chicago, for example. Chicago Public Schools has a $700 million deficit, a 56% graduation rate, which some say is actually high, artificially high. When you've got those kinds of results, I think the last thing that students should be focusing on is these types of fringe issues.
Well, to what degree have these types of fringe issues been introduced into the curriculum in Chicago schools? Do you have any data on that?
Well, there's an organization called Teachers for Social Justice, and what I tried to do at the end of the book is talk about some of the organizations, some of the individuals that are really, you know, especially pushing these things. And so there's an organization called Teachers for Social Justice, which is based here, but there are other affiliates around the country. And they push these types of ideas out to teachers. And so they hold a curriculum fair each year. And unfortunately, in Chicago, literally hundreds of teachers show up. And I understand there's lots of teachers. But hundreds of teachers show up each year to get these materials, which then, of course, they incorporate into their lesson plans and push into the minds of young kids.
You quote the president of Williams College, I think, in your book. Somebody asked him, with regard to presidential election of 2004, how did his faculty vote? And he proudly announces that every one of them voted
For John Kerry.
For John Kerry, mm-hmm. the Democratic candidate. That's pretty far away. That's a posh and elite Ivy League college rather than the schools of Chicago. But it seems that at college levels, you tend to get a general leftish disposition. In fact, from my many years of university and college teaching, I know that to be the case in the social sciences and increasingly in the humanities, but not necessarily in the business schools nor in the hard sciences. There are differences. There are disciplinary differences with regard to political preference. But is it your impression that most teachers in public school systems are like the faculty about which the president of Williams was bragging?
No, I don't. And in fact, it's been interesting in doing interviews and talking about this book. I've been contacted by many teachers who say, you know, I don't support this. I've been asked to teach these things or told to teach these things, and I refused. And so I think there's this fight that's going on right now in public education where you have some teachers that are resisting this type of indoctrination. But then, unfortunately, you have people like Ayers or Klonsky who are very intent on pushing it.
But you also have the major teachers' unions. You have the National Education Association, and the other is the American Federation of Teachers.
Mm-hmm.
Where do they stand on these matters?
Well, that's interesting because a lot of the dues payers are fairly equally broken up between liberal, independent, and conservative. But unfortunately, the people that are calling the shots, the people that are elected, the staff, are very far left. And so that's why you see them giving money to organizations like ACORN, for example, or giving money to leftist organizations that have a very clear agenda that has nothing to do with education. But unfortunately, I think it gets to the fact that the teachers' unions have moved beyond just simply being professional organizations and have turned into political organizations.
And do they also push upon the teacher members of those two unions curricula which slant things in this sort of indoctrinating direction?
Absolutely. If you go onto the Chicago Teachers Union website, for example,
what do you find?
They have lesson plans dealing with Occupy, dealing with economics and those sorts of things. And I can reassure everyone that they don't look too kindly on free
lesson
markets
plans
and capitalism.
Dealing with Occupy. You mean the Occupy movement that's
correct
been filling our streets, various American cities?
Snarling traffic.
What are their lesson plans about the Occupy movement? What do they recommend teachers do in the classroom?
Sure. Well, you look at Chicago or Oakland or whatever the case may be, and they want to make sure that kids understand why the protesters are in the streets, and it's they want to change the economic model of America, and that's what they talk about. Now they use coded words and vague language and those sorts of things. But, you know, they don't look at it from, well, what has free markets brought to not only America but the world? And because of capitalism and because of free markets and innovation and all of those things, look what America has done for humanity.
They don't offer that as essay challenges that a kid has to write on.
Correct.
Rather, they ask for essays on what topics? Or on what propositions?
On why are you part of the 99% and all of those sorts of things. I mean, it's a very – and as I said earlier, that is really my problem with it, is that it's a very biased curriculum. It's not let's have a hearty debate as a classroom and, you know, defend your position. If you're a socialist or you're a communist, defend that position. If you're a capitalist, defend that position. Oftentimes what we're seeing around the country is that there is a biased method that's being pushed, and students need to work into that method. Otherwise, they will be penalized.
Surely one major area in which that sort of bias might well rear its head and might influence curricular content is history, and particularly the history of the United States. We're about to pause for an update on the news and some commercials. After that, it would be good to talk about what they're doing with in representing and interpreting the story of this country itself. It's a mixed story. One would have to really acknowledge it isn't all virtue, it isn't all beauty, it isn't all enlightenment and kindness and social justice, but it's by no means all negative either. And I wonder what they're doing with it. I look to you for some further elucidation along those lines after we go to the newsroom and get an update from Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Kyle Olson. We are drawing from his new book, Indoctrination, How Useful Idiots Are Using Our Schools to Subvert American Exceptionalism. Now, I think back to the time when I was a little boy and first learned about the Founding Fathers and the Revolution and the making of the Constitution and so on. And it was taught in a way that essentially aroused attitudes of reverence towards the Founding Fathers. It was taught without much realism about some of the complexities, economic and social and racial, that may have haunted even the meeting of the Continental Congress in Philadelphia, so that I came out as a little patriot with that sense of the founding. I don't know that that was doing me ill, but it wasn't totally and complexly accurate, was it?
Well, there's a revision, I think, of American history that's going on within our schools. And in the book, I talk about Ray Raphael, who makes this argument that the fight for independence actually came about because, quote, people had learned the power of collaborative effort. And so the argument that is going on is that it actually was this collective American revolution. And it was all of these people, and for whatever reason, just the Founding Fathers are getting credit. And so
The argument tends to be it wasn't the Founding Fathers who really did it. It was the people.
Yes, exactly.
The people who did it.
And so they just simply were the leaders, and so they got the credit. But really, it was the people at the bottom that actually, you know, did all the heavy lifting. And while obviously they couldn't have had a revolution without the people that were willing to fight, clearly, if you look at Thomas Jefferson and the others and the brilliance that they brought to the table, I mean, they were the reason that there was not only a revolution but the Constitution. And
but
the
I would
America
bet that in
had.
Teaching these matters, if you're following a progressive curriculum, and you mentioned Thomas Jefferson, inevitably you also work in the next sentence that he was a slaveholder.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And that, to me, that's the trouble, is that the progressives want to, you know, ridicule and demonize the American history, again, because I believe it's their mission to undercut America and just make us, you know, not this exceptional country that we are, but just someone who has a country that has, you know, raped and pillaged the world. And so now it's our responsibility to give that back.
Well, one other area in which you can do a good deal with how we raped and pillaged is the settling of the West and the slaughter of the Indians. That's another theme that gets a lot of attention, does it not?
Absolutely. And again, it's—
But there's some justice to it. Or there's some element of truth in that we were rather beastly to lots of Indians.
That's right. That's right. But I think what is happening is that there is this a movement towards retribution, and so I think it's a dangerous direction that we're going.
You've mentioned the Occupy movement, which is there right now, that great simplification of the structure of this society, that there's 1% who are skimming off all the cream and the rest are— the 99% are living on skimmed milk, as it were, or worse. Does that coincide somehow with the kind of progressive curriculum that you're talking about?
It does. And I think that's precisely why the Chicago Teachers Union was out protesting and leading Occupy Chicago. It's because, again, that is where the mindset of the leadership is, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's not doing anything to improve education in the city of Chicago. But instead, I think what's happening is that they're skewing the problems. And so instead of saying, you know, what can we do as individuals to improve our system, improve our life, instead what they're doing is they're showing up on a street corner and pointing at, you know, the people, the so-called 1%, and saying it's their fault and we're going to get them. And so unfortunately, that is now making its way into our schools. And again, I think it all gets back to indoctrinating our students to fit the personal political agenda of a fringe.
We've talked about math and we've talked about history. What other curricular areas are also capable of this sort of infection?
Sure. In the book, I talk about a series of lesson plans actually written by the United Nations about turning American students into global citizens. And while obviously there's a critical need for American leadership in the world, but what the United Nations is talking about is that we need to be on a level playing field with every other country. We use up too many resources, we hoard too many resources, and therefore America needs to give more. And so it's interesting to think in those terms, but of course what they don't want to talk about is what exactly would America look like if that were the case. And even the people on protesting Occupy, they have a pretty comfortable life. And do people really want to go down that road where we are forced, because we voluntarily we do give a lot of resources in humanitarian aid, foreign aid, and those sorts of things, but we do it because we believe it's the right thing to do. But just imagine having the United Nations coming into America and mandating, requiring Americans to give up more.
Staying with history for a moment, it occurs to me another major area of history which would be of interest to kids and which reflects events still not so far back in the recesses of history that no one remembers them is World War II. Fascinating subject. Kids in school now have grandparents who remember that time and mm-hmm. even grandfathers or even grandmothers who might have served in the military at that time. I'm just wondering, I really don't know the answer to this. How do a modern curricula of the sort we're talking about, pushed by the teachers' unions and widely used and by various other organizations and widely used in the public schools of Chicago, New York, Denver, San Francisco, how do they treat the war?
Actually, I haven't come across that very much. I think in that area, teachers tend to rely on textbooks. And so it really kind of depends on the quality of the textbook that they adopt. What I have seen when it comes to these types of indoctrination things is the founding of America, the industrialization of America, the union, the development of unions and those sorts of things. I think that is where they're trying to bend it towards their direction. And I frankly, I haven't come across anything dealing with World War II.
Well, I've read something. I can't give you the exact citation at the moment, that indicating that when teaching World War II and focused on the Pacific War, there are some progressive approaches which have been used in some schools or pushed by some teachers, putting a stress on the injustice we did to the Japanese.
Oh.
That the Japanese were, in fact, the nation was misused by the United States in terms of denying them access to raw materials. But more than that, our general approach to them was sort of a racist approach, that we viewed people of East Asia or as lesser people.
I have heard that line, and I've heard the argument that they did want to surrender, but we didn't want them to surrender because we wanted to use the bombs anyway. I didn't come across that in K-12, but I mean, I've heard that for myself in my college courses.
We haven't talked about college curricula and about what happens in the universities and colleges these days, but I know that scene quite well, having spent all of my life until a few years ago teaching in colleges and universities, including a long, long run at the University of Chicago. And it is certainly true that a general progressive, I guess is the word we're settled upon, left of center, sometimes considerably left of center, approach to issues of social order and issues of the economy and surely issues of justice and its distribution or maldistribution that and international relations, et cetera, that most of those topics and most of those areas are approached with a rather significant and clear leftist orientation.
I think that's exactly right. And so what I tried to do, you bring up higher education, what I tried to do is look at K-12, because arguably you've got kids that obviously are very impressionable. And they don't necessarily in their development as human beings, they can't necessarily comprehend all of these issues and that sort of thing. And so that's what I find most insidious about this, is that you've got impressionable kids who don't necessarily know or can't necessarily form an opinion just simply because that's not where they are in their human development. But these types of issues are being pushed at very young ages. I mean, one example is in the city of Milwaukee, and I get into this in the book, there was a teacher who in her third grade class was teaching her students about the school budget, you know, massive school district budget. And then she was having the students write letters to the school board talking about why their budget should not be cut. And so, you know, you think third graders, these are what, 8-year-olds, not maybe 9-year-old, they can't hardly even comprehend their family budget, much less a school district budget. And so it's discouraging and outraging to see these examples of where the activists employ the students to do their dirty work.
There is an interesting additional question. If you make clear to kids that you've got strong attitudes of a certain sort with regard to political and social issues, and you expect them to represent those views themselves in essays they write or in little speeches they give or in letters they write to the school board or whatever, this is going to ultimately, for some kids at least, intimidate them into voicing those opinions as if they are their own, internalizing those opinions, because that's the way you win the approval and avoid the disapproval of the teacher.
That's right, and get a good grade.
And that
to me, that's the trouble, is that if you had students write an essay about communism, you know, and say, is it good, is it bad, you know, was it good for humanity or not, defend that position, and just let kids state a position and defend it. I think that's a very healthy exercise, regardless of what the topic is. But oftentimes, what we see is that there is an agenda that's being pushed where students have to come to a certain conclusion, and if they don't, they'll be penalized for it.
There's another area in which some parents complain or are concerned, and that is that the schools not only engage in certain kinds of teaching with a political slant, but rather also are arrogate to themselves the right to shape the character or reorganize the character of the kids. They are too inquisitive about what happens back home. They undertake to kind of teach morality, sometimes even in contradiction to what might be presented by family or by church or what have you, that the privacy of the child is in some ways violated, and attempts to shape him into a certain kind of human being mm-hmm. with certain kinds of broader lasting attitudes takes its place. In other words, that schools are presuming to get too deeply involved in the lives of their students. I don't know whether you share that view or not, but I want to hear what you have to say about that when we return after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we return to Kyle Olson. We're drawing from, maybe we're going beyond in the next segment, his book, Indoctrination, How Useful Idiots Are Using Our Schools to Subvert American Exceptionalism. How are the schools? Am I right that the schools are kind of getting into the lives of the kids more than they should?
Absolutely. There's a theory pushed primarily, well, by several people, but probably most notable is Randy Weingarten, who is the president of the American Federation of Teachers. It's their theory that we should have the schools the center of the community. And so if people need medical care, they can go to the school. If they need to be educated, they can go to the school. If they need an after-school program, they can go to the school. And so they want the school and the people within the school to be the shapers of the community. And so, you know, looking at all of these different types of issues, I view this as a slippery slope where the school will be the shaper of the culture, the shaper of society. And looking at these issues in this book, to me, that's a scary notion.
A term that pops up all the time when you talk about the development of young people becoming fully endowed adults is, quote, gender, and sometimes more directly, sexuality. There's a fair amount of talk about that, even at elementary school levels, or do you wait until middle school? I don't know.
Well, what I see is The sex ed and those types of issues are being pushed on kids at very young ages, where they're encouraged to, you know, explore these issues and learn about safe sex and all of these things. And again, at very young ages. And we hear from parents.
How young? What do you?
Kindergartners.
Really?
Very, very young ages.
What do you do with about safe sex in a kindergarten?
I don't know. but they're pushing these issues. And so we hear from parents across the country who say, you know, I believe that's the role of my church or the role of my family, the mother and the father, to teach those things to their child. And instead, they're being usurped by the school. And what they find most troubling about that is that they cannot opt out, or there are a few things that they can opt out of, but then there are other subjects that are mandatory that their child has to go to.
Such as?
Just more general about homosexuality and those types of things, I think it's a disturbing direction that our schools are going. And again, they're being pushed by activists within our schools. I mean, you look at one of the things that I find disturbing about the teachers' unions is that they are not professional organizations; they are political, hyper-political organizations. And they don't just focus on, you know, how can we elect school board candidates so then we can negotiate with them the next contract. But they look at they give funds to organizations like ACORN or organizations like GLSEN.
What is GLSEN?
GLSEN is a gay rights organization that was founded by Kevin Jennings. Kevin Jennings later went on to the Obama administration, where he was the safe school czar. But it is this hypersexualized agenda where they're pushing these issues on kids at very young ages. And I think it's an area that should be left up to parents to make that choice. And unfortunately, more and more the examples are coming out where parents don't have a choice, and the school is usurping that role.
A very basic question that we need to address is, how did progressive ideation and orientation of the sort that you say flourishes in the community of educators, public educators, how did it come to flourish? How did this come to be sort of the normative content of the teacher culture?
Well, if you look back 100 years, the progressives, they were looking at changing America, and they said, well, we can attempt to win elections and change America that way, but an election can easily be reversed with the next election, and all the gains that they will have made will be reversed. And so they took a very clear agenda of attempting to control education, control the media, and control Hollywood. And so, unfortunately, individuals like Bill Ayers, we'll bring him up again, they set out to go into the classroom. And in fact, in one of his books, he writes, "I left the jail and went straight to the classroom." I'm paraphrasing, but that's what he said. And so they view the classroom, they view our schools as their place where they will change America. They will change the culture of America.
But they would have to be a small sort of conspiratorial group, as you describe them. How does this become a generalized movement or a generalized set of ideas widely commended by and internalized by thousands and thousands of teachers?
Well, I think largely it starts within the schools of education, where teachers become teachers.
What happens there?
Well, what happens there is you've got, again, the likes of Bill Ayers, who are professors of education. Mm-hmm. They're teaching teachers how to be teachers. And they're shaping their philosophy. They're shaping their mindset. And so then they will bring those values and that mindset into the classroom and that philosophy of teaching into the classroom. And that's why I think you see so much pushback on accountability, on using standardized tests to judge teachers and to judge students. The philosophy, the Bill Ayers philosophy of education, generally speaking, is that it should be this mutual discovery between the teacher and the student. And the student should learn from the teacher and vice versa.
Is Ayers the villain of this whole piece? Would it not have happened if he had turned his interests elsewhere?
No, I think it would have still happened. But he has been a very persuasive and influential figure within this context of progressivism in our government schools.
They made him the president, did they not, or was it vice president of some education research or national association?
That's right. And that's precisely the point, is he was the vice president of curriculum studies for this organization. And this is – it's a very heady organization, and liberals and conservatives join this organization. It's essentially a
– What's the name of the organization?
It's the American – it's AERA. It's American something Research Association, Education mm-hmm. Research Association.
Right. Uh-huh.
And so what happens is they have these conferences and meetings and things where education researchers all get together and share ideas. But there's a very clear social justice agenda to it.
Mm-hmm.
He recently won their Social Justice and Education Award. And so to me, he became this figure during the 2008 election for his activities in the 60s.
I am Professor Emeritus of the University of Chicago. Anybody who's been through an academic career, when he or she retires, ultimately becomes an emeritus or an emerita, depending upon gender. The one retired professor in this town who has been refused emeritus status is Bill Ayers.
That's right.
You want to tell that story?
No, I don't know that story.
Well, the story is that he was blackballed by the head of the governing board of the University of Illinois at Chicago, who happens to be a son of Robert Kennedy.
Interesting.
And Ayers wrote a preface to, or at least was, or commended in a preface to one of his books, among other great American heroes, Sirhan Sirhan, the man who assassinated Robert Kennedy.
That's right. And so, and that is the mindset, I think, that is being pushed within our schools of education.
Yeah.
And so, again, you know, this is not every teacher, but I think what is happening is that this culture is being developed. And so that way K-12 teachers, higher education professors are bringing that into the classroom.
We're going to pause in just a moment for an update on the news. But before that, I do want to quickly invite telephone calls. We'd love to hear from people engaged in the educational enterprise, whether you agree or disagree, or whether you've got any kind of personal experience you want to offer as relevant to this discussion. And of course, parents are equally welcome. And students of the older variety who've been through school, young people who have something to report about what's happened in the school systems through which they've recently passed. 312-591-7200 is the number. And the lines are open right now. We'll be getting to the phones probably in about 10 or 12 minutes. So if you want to be heard, get in there quickly. Any question you want to raise, any testimony you want to offer, any opinion you want to voice. 312-591-7200. And if you want to get to us via email, the email address is, of course, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. Extension 720 at WGNradio.com. Or again, for calls, 312-591-7200.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we return to a conversation with Kyle Olson. The book that we're drawing from is titled Indoctrination. I mentioned earlier that Useful Idiots, which you used in your subtitle, was coined by Lenin, I think.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. What did he mean by useful idiots?
It was.
And what do you mean?
He came up with that term for Americans who in effect were, well, they were doing the bidding of the Soviet Union, but they in effect were undermining America.
Uh-huh.
And so that was his term, was useful idiots. And so what I mean by it today is that you've got people on the left who are in our schools who are obviously the Soviet Union is no longer here, but they're doing the very same thing.
Well, now, we don't want the left to disappear, do we? I mean, that is a wide range of opinion and continuing debate on issues of public policy. That's the very nature of the game, is it not?
Absolutely. And that's why it's healthy to have debate and to debate these ideas and these issues.
Because your point is to leave the kids alone. Let them
leave the kids
work
alone.
It out for themselves later on.
That's right. And if you want to have healthy debates in high school or higher education, that certainly, I think, is appropriate.
Yeah.
But leave the young kids alone.
Maybe then you have a little bit more time to do the serious educating that is required and that sometimes is honored as much in the breach as in the observance.
That's right. And so, again, like I said earlier, my trouble with this is that we have a government education system which is underperforming in many parts of America. And so I think we need to be looking at the fundamentals of education, making sure that kids are prepared for higher education, prepared for a career, just prepared for life.
Well, now, of course, there are also structural issues. That is to say, you can do education without necessarily relying solely upon publicly funded and publicly managed schools.
That's right. And so what parents are looking at is they're, I think, increasingly looking at their options. And so I think because of a lot of these cultural issues that are going on in our schools, we're seeing increasing numbers of parents homeschooling, which I think if parents are up for that, I think that's a very worthwhile endeavor. You're looking at parents who are continuing to fund the public education system through their tax dollars, but they're saying, I want my child to get a religious-based education or a private school education, so they're looking at that. But then also, in Chicago is a great example, is you've got a public charter school movement that is increasing as well. I mean, you had the mayor just approve, city council just approve 12 new charter schools here in this city. And so you've got, I think, increasing options, which I think will improve everything.
An outstanding question, which is capable of being researched and has been rather heavily investigated, is do the charter schools do better than the public schools? The picture that the data present is still a mixed one, is it not?
There are some schools that do worse, and there are some schools that do better. But I think what's an important aspect of charter schools is that it literally is a charter between the school and the authorizing body, whether it's Chicago Public Schools or a university or whatever the case may be. And that charter states if that school is not performing and it's not living up to the expectations in its charter, it is shut down. And unfortunately, you can't say that for a Detroit Public Schools or a Chicago Public Schools. Those schools just continue on in perpetuity regardless of what the results are. And so I think the incentive for a charter school is that if it's not performing, then it is shut down. But you look at – and let me back up for a second. So in 2 weeks is National School Choice Week. And Juan Williams and I put a film together to be released during National School Choice
Juan
Week.
Juan Williams, the fellow
of NPR and now on Fox
Television News.
Correct.
Yeah.
And what we looked at is this fight for school choice in the city of Chicago, where we looked at we actually visited Noble Street College Prep, and which has great results, has a great environment, great teachers, a great working environment, and all of those sorts of things. And those students are just, you know, just really outperforming their peers in that very same neighborhood. And so we looked at that, and then we looked at the contrast with Chicago Public Schools and how a 56% graduation rate, huge budget deficits. You've got the Chicago Teachers Union out in the streets almost every day, protesting for higher raises, protesting for 100% pensions, protesting against a longer school day, all of those sorts of things. And so it's called a tale of two missions, mm-hmm. where we look at these differing missions, how they intersect, how they split ways.
This is a film that you've done, you say?
That's correct. It's called A Tale of Two Missions, and it will be out in 2 weeks.
To be visible on television or in theaters or what?
Well, we're still working out those details. It is available on DVD, and uh-huh. so I would invite everyone to go to schoolchoiceweek.com, and a DVD can be ordered that way.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. We're going to pause right now, another quick round of commercials, then on to the phones. For a while, all the lines were taken, but I see that some are available again. Not everybody makes the cut. But if you've got something to say, something to, merely to ask, that's fine. Or if you've got something to say, because you've got opinions or you've got experience that you want to share, we'd be delighted to hear from you. 312-591-7200. Calling all teachers, former teachers, students, former students, parents, grandparents, concerned
taxpayers,
whatever. Well, education is everybody's business.
That's right. You have we to be all
a,
pay for it.
You have to be a hermit living out of all contact with all possible other human relatives or friends to not be somehow invested in the question of whether we're educating properly within the society.
That's exactly right. We're all taxpayers, property yeah. taxes, sales yeah. taxes. So we own the system, and taxpayers need to exert our influence over it.
312-591-7200. Get your calls in quickly. We'll be with you directly after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we will go directly and quickly to the phones. 312-591-7200 is the number, and the first caller is Carol. Good evening.
Hi there. I couldn't disagree with your guest more. Particularly in the area of science, what's being pushed in a lot of states is this creationism stuff being forced. It's totally unscientific. I've got people I know personally who don't know what a theory is in terms of scientific standards, that this is something, not theoretically, something that's been
proved. What school system is that you're talking about?
Kansas and Texas in particular are the ones that I know of.
Is that where you're calling from?
I'm calling from Chicago.
Uh-huh.
I come from four generations of teachers.
Uh-huh.
Both grandparents, both of my parents, an aunt, half dozen cousins, and three of my four niece-in-laws.
Great. Well, this is very, very valuable. And they're teaching creationism in the public schools?
Yes, in the public schools. It's mandated. Teachers required to teach it. And in Texas, they have gone through and completely rewritten the history books to de-emphasize, among other things, de-emphasize Jefferson because he's too much of a liberal. And because the Texas school system is so large, curriculum is mandated, it's statewide. mandated, and because it's so large and they order so many books, the textbook companies are being forced to write textbooks specifically that meet the Texas criteria.
Yeah. Well, this is yours is a very valuable call, and let's process this in further conversation. I want to say just one thing with regard to creationism. I know some people favor, quote, teach the conflict or teach the debate. I would never agree to that. Creationism is nonsense. And you don't teach nonsense, even if it's religiously sponsored. And you're right, that's yielding to right-wing pressure, and I don't think the right-wing should be forceful and influential within a school system any more than I think the left-wing should be. But
let me... there is a corollary on the right-wing for almost every single one of the things he's brought up about the left-wing. I see it happening, I hear about it. From teachers, my family, my cousins who are teachers.
Down there in the Southwest?
In the Midwest and Southwest.
Well, I don't think anything like that happens in Chicago schools.
Are they teaching just creationism?
They call it intelligent design.
Yeah, well, that's a variant of creationism.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But they're required to teach that along with evolution, and they have to... teach both of them.
Yeah, well, let's get some. Man, hold on a minute now. Hold on a minute. Let's get some response from Kyle Olson.
Well, my intent of the book is to show how the left is changing America away from free markets, away from capitalism, away from individualism and those sorts of things. But she is exactly right. What is happening, and you look at Texas and you look at California, for example, and the standards that they pass then will be the rule of the road for textbooks across the country, because textbook manufacturers write their books geared towards primarily those two states.
Right.
And what I get into in the book is some of the regulations or requirements that have passed in the state of California with regard to teaching gay history and union history and those sorts of things, because then those ideas or those concepts then show up in textbooks in Illinois or South Carolina or you know, any other state. And so I believe that our government schools – look, if someone wants to send their child to a religious school – or a private school, and they want to pay for that, they should have that option, and you know, I'm perfectly fine with that. And they can, if the parent knows about it, then they should be able to teach whatever they want.
You know what I think, in a way, is reflected here. There certainly are schools that have, not so much in this part of the country as elsewhere, that do have a strong right wing influence upon their teaching. Very often, it comes indeed from evangelical or fundamentalist religious organizations, particularly as regards evolutionary theory. But it may well be that what we see here is kind of a polarization in the schools, which is parallel to a polarization in the country, that the left has become more extreme and the right, perhaps in reaction to the left's increasing vehemence, has also become more extreme.
And the conservative states are passing certain standards and the more liberal states are passing certain standards.
Yeah.
I think there is something to that.
Ma'am, we thank you for the call. That's a valuable contribution, surely. And quickly to the next caller, who is Eddie. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yeah, good evening, gentlemen. Why do you think, the parents of rich parents send? Why don't they send their kids to regular schools? Why do they send them to private schools? Kind of to indoctrinate them with their own beliefs,
or simply to get a better education?
Yeah. I think some of these universities should lose their tax exemption status.
Why?
Well, I mean, politics doesn't belong in the school. That's for the individual to figure that out on their own by doing research.
Well, politics gets a lot of play in university curricula, if only because they are addressing social history and political history. It's fine for young college students to debate, and for that matter, even to oppose a professor. But those professors who use the college classroom as a way of indoctrinating their students are also overstepping the legitimate boundaries. As a matter of fact, at the University of Chicago, there's been a kind of a student revolt at times against coming, I must say, mostly from Jewish students, against some of the professors who are so anti-Israeli, and so so anti-Zionist, they would say, rather than anti-Jewish. But that's become almost a rigmarole that students have to go through and have to yield to if they're going to have peaceful relations with the professor. Many of them have simply been outraged by that and have complained to higher persons, to deans and deanlets and so on. But that has never been properly resolved there, not fully, I think, from what I hear. And that is a problem which shows up in lots of American universities these days.
Mm-hmm. And with regard to his first question, I think the reason a lot of parents some parents take their kids out of the traditional public system and put them in a private school is so they can get a better education.
Well, sure.
And it's unfortunate that they are required to not only pay taxes for the traditional public system, but then also have to pay tuition for a private school.
We go back to the phones. I should say we've now got a few lines available. If you've been trying to reach us, try again. I want to hear from teachers in the public school system, whether here in Chicago or anywhere else in the country where we're reaching you. 312-591-7200. Not only from teachers, but to be sure from administrators and from union teachers, union leaders. Anybody and everybody involved in these questions is welcome, whatever your opinion. But get in there quickly, 312-591-7200. Next up is Aris, I think is the name. Good evening.
Yes, Milt and your distinguished guest, Aris, like Aristotle. I'd like to tell you, I'm sorry I tuned in late to the program, but it's really refreshing to hear a person like Mr. Olson who has independent ideas and also the courage to express them. And I want to just say that education is the most valuable and the least compensated profession, because everything we are and everything we hope to be, we owe to our teachers. Now, I am a lawyer myself, and I'll tell you that in a way I'm a beneficiary, but I'm also a victim of higher education. Because I start out as an A student in grammar school, B in high school, C in college, graduate school, I flunked out. I was a D student. So in other words, the more I got up into academic education, the dumber I became. And I'm telling you now one little thing that I finished. It took me 45 years to figure out. I went to a prestigious Midwest college where I remember, I never learned in high school, college, law school, nowhere. There was never taught one page of the British view of the American Revolution. And this is how deficient my education was and still is, and I'm sure for millions of other students of higher education. And so I went back to college about 49, 50 years after I graduated for a reunion there, and I said, everybody's giving money. I said, no, I'm not going to give money. I want a refund of half of my tuition because you guys gave me only half of the truth.
Uh-huh.
Perfectly example, which took me 45 years after graduation to figure out that I was taught only the American view. You could get a PhD in American history. In fact, a Rhodes Scholar who was a professor there and president, he told me, he said, I never read a page of the British view either. And he was a Rhodes Scholar. So I end with this. The deficiency, unfortunately, of our higher education. And again, I thank you for this very stimulating and independent thinker that you have on the program.
And we thank you, sir, for the very interesting autobiographical exegesis. And with that, we need to pause in just a moment for an update on the evening's news. But first, let me say that, again, we've got some lines available. If you've been trying to reach us, make another quick try. And if you haven't been trying to reach us, you should be trying. We want to know what experience you've had with public education and what your attitudes and judgments might be. 312-591-7200. And for email, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. Now to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Here's an interesting email that has just come in. I had an experience on a road trip with a 27-year-old new graduate of the University of Kentucky Dental School. We are both car collectors. Our trip took us past Fulton, Missouri. As you well know, Fulton, Missouri is famous for Winston Churchill's post-war introduction speech of the term Iron Curtain. As we passed Fulton, I asked my young friend if he knew who Winston Churchill was. And amazingly, this is how it caps, he did not know who Churchill was. I was stunned. This says to me that those in charge of the curriculum feel that the most significant event of the 20th century doesn't deserve examination. This young man is very bright. He was not exposed to this recent history. This is from a listener, Paul, in Richmond, Kentucky. Well, sure, that's not at all surprising to me. Listeners to this program have grown sick of me repeating again and again that I used to give a cultural literacy quiz on the last day of my largest course, the course in social psychology at the University of Chicago. 10 items, obvious items, including what are the dates of the Civil War? And not one out of 10 could give you the proper dates or put it even in the proper decade. This is... when it comes to the actual items of culture, items of history, of literature, and so on, that fill the mind of a more or less educated person, there are great vacuities that we encounter all the time now.
I agree, and I think we continue to see the standards drop, the rigorous academics, the rigorous curriculum decline.
Yeah.
And I think it's a dangerous path that America is on.
We need to put more time into education and less time into some of the political propagandizing lightly disguised as education, which simply eats up too much time, I suppose.
That's right. And so what we see a lot of times is this lack of history. And, you know, the saying is if you don't know history, you're doomed to repeat it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, you know, you look at what's going on in the Middle East and the saber rattling by Iran and everything, and you think about Hitler and what he did to the Jews. And I mean, people need to know history so we can try and avoid the things that happened in the past.
We go back to the phones. We need to know much more of American history, apart from all the obvious stuff about the Founding Fathers and the Civil War and so on. We need to know the main currents of political thought. And the sources of those currents, which go back to the European Enlightenment, go back to people like Montesquieu and Locke and so on, and how they informed the thinking of our founding fathers is not commonly taught or understood by anybody, at least not when they arrive as freshmen in a major university. 312-591-7200. And next up is Jack, who is welcome at WGN Radio. Good evening, sir.
Hi, Milt. I'm a long-time listener of your show. I'm a first-time caller. You have a very interesting program tonight.
Thank you.
I'm currently in high school, and what I find to be a problem...
You're in high school. How can you be a long-time listener?
Well, I've been listening since a very young age. So.
Oh, that's delightful. Go ahead.
In my personal experience, I think a lot of the curriculum is watered down, and there's a lot of indoctrination being done by some of my teachers in the courses I'm taking. And also, occasionally, I find that some of the teachers aren't qualified necessarily to speak about the subjects that they're teaching in. I was wondering what your guest, Mr. Olson, thinks about this.
Well, before that, tell me, when you speak of lots of indoctrination, what kind of indoctrination with regard to what?
Last year in my U.S. history class, I had a teacher who was a very leftist, and it just seemed like his whole view of American history was skewed by his political belief. So it made the class very hard, and it made it very hard to get a balanced view of United States history.
What propositions about American history was he pushing on you?
He was very race-centered in his class and gender-centered, and he made it, in my opinion, I think that he over-analyzed everything that the Founding Fathers did, and he seems to think that most of the callers, or not the...
Yes, go ahead. What has happened to the call? Suddenly the call has disappeared. That's sad.
It is sad.
That's frustrating. Something went wrong with the technology, I'm sure.
And what's interesting to me is, I don't think he said what grade he's in, but what's interesting to me is that kids are picking up on that, and they're seeing that the personal agenda is coming through. And so the question then, I think, then is what do they do about it? Or do they just, you know, do what they need to do in order to get the grade? And so what I got into in the book is specific steps that parents, elected officials, and taxpayers can take.
Such as
they need, if a parent or a student sees this going on, they need to stand up and do something about it. They need to tell the teacher that this is not appropriate, go to the principal, go to the superintendent, the school board. But they need to bring attention to these things, because if they don't do it, it's possible that no one else will.
And that should be the injunction to the young person, perhaps at a school in Oklahoma or Texas, who is offended by the fact that they're pushing creationism on him. He should as well complain.
If there's
right-wing indoctrination or left-wing indoctrination.
That's right. If
indoctrination doesn't belong in the schools.
That's right. If there are things that they think are inappropriate, they need to speak up and do something about them.
We go quickly back to the phones. I hope that the phone system holds up for the next caller. That caller is Rita. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hello. Good to hear you guys talking about something that's so pertinent right now. My father and I actually were just talking about this tonight while we were working. I have a young son who's in third grade, and the school system that he's a part of, obviously when I bought my house, I didn't have kids and I didn't check very well. And I did my best to be a volunteer at the school. I'm there all the time. I participate in all activities. And it just seems that he's hit a wall at the school. And now we're looking into switching him to a private school because their scores at the school he's currently at are so low. They're considered a spotlight school, which apparently means that they're like a low-income school that has consistently raised their levels, but they're still below the national average. And he's part of a larger school district, which all tend to be minority schools, it turned out. And we're switching him over, hopefully, for fourth grade. But I'm concerned that, you know, does your guest happen to know if that's a good move? Like, is the quality of education actually better in the private sector versus the public? Right now, you know, he doesn't have a lot of the political issues that some of the previous callers and maybe his book deals with. Obviously, being a low-income school, they do tend to, you know, be a little bit more sympathetic to the African-American plight than they do any other, because the majority of his school is African-American, and then there is a little bit of Hispanic, and then the white is very small. But is there a real difference? Because I don't want to switch him and make him go through a transition at a crucial period, fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade, and on to eighth, just to find out that it's pretty much the same exact teaching, or because he's in third grade, but he's testing at fifth grade math levels and fifth grade reading levels, and they're not challenging him, and his scores are consistently, you know, 30% above the district's average.
Right.
Already, and I'm just, you know, I don't want to make the wrong decision for him, but it was that or homeschooling, and I'm just afraid he's not going to listen to me. I'm his mother.
Right. Have you looked at the options in your neighborhood or where you live?
Yeah, right now, I mean, we even sent a letter, me and another concerned parent sent a letter to the superintendent of the nearby school district. The funny thing is we live across the street from the right school district in our town. I live in Oak Forest. If you're on the east side of Cicero, he's at this school. If you're on the west side of Cicero, you are at all the other better schools, all the better school districts. We sent a letter asking, can we just pay an out-of-district fee and just drive our kid in? And they're like, no, there is no out-of-district fee unless, you know.
Ma'am, I fear we're approaching a moment when we have to stop for some commercials. So let's get a further response.
Sure. Well, to me, that's the great ripoff, is that kids have to go to school, generally speaking, by and large. Kids go to school based on where they live, and not based on what school best meets their needs. And so I would just really encourage you to look at not only traditional public options, but look at a charter school option. Those are public schools. They accept public funds. But the culture is different because a lot of them are not unionized. There's just a different culture. The expectations are higher. The accountability is higher, and those sorts of things. But then also look at virtual schooling, which tends to involve your child being home more. It's kind of a version of homeschooling, I guess. But look at all of those options, and it's really critical to look at the achievement of the school and not just simply, you know, what looks good.
And with that, we pause for a last round of commercials, then right back to the phones.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And the high school student who was talking with us a while ago, Jack, has called back, and here he is again. Good evening.
Hi, how are you?
What happened?
I don't know what happened, but with my history class, is that what you wanted to know?
Yeah.
Okay. So it seemed as though every day he would, there would be a solid 20 minutes a day that he would spend talking to us about current events or other things, and then it really just like detracted from the class, and it made the experience very bad. And I feel like I didn't get a proper understanding of American history. I had to rely on other sources to find out what I was really looking for in the class rather than listening from my instructor.
What grade was that?
I was a junior in high school.
Okay. Do you remember using The People's History of the United States? Did you use that book?
No, I don't think so. I think I used an AP-level textbook.
Okay. Okay, interesting. Well, and as I said, I don't know if you heard me earlier, but it's interesting that you would pick up on that. Did you do something about it, or did you just kind of grin and bear it, or what did you do?
I grinned and bear it because I didn't really want to, I didn't want to start anything with the teacher. He was a nice guy, but I just felt as though this is a pattern I see happening a lot, especially in the social studies department where it's very subjective.
Mm-hmm. Were you required to give certain answers that would essentially fit within his personal personal beliefs?
I found that in most of my classes, whenever sometimes I would say something or speak out against what he was saying, not speak out, but I would like I would present alternative views, and I found that whenever I did this, he would just become very defensive and then almost like embarrass me in front of the class.
Mm-hmm.
So I found it. I just think that this is a very big problem in our schools. It's just like political views getting in the way of our education.
Well, is he exceptional, or do you have other teachers who essentially are?
I've had some other teachers, especially this year. I'm in a philosophy class, and this philosophy class, it's not structured like a traditional philosophy class. I haven't learned about any of the philosophers like Aristotle or Socrates that I was planning on learning about. Instead, we've talked about current events. We spent a whole unit on Nazism, but that doesn't really pertain to philosophy. And then most of the class is just my instructor just talking about his beliefs and things like that and trying to convince us that his views are right.
I want to ask you the particular high school, but is it in the city or in the suburbs of Chicago?
Suburbs.
Yeah. Well, that's a report from the field, which confirms a good deal of what we have in the book by Kyle Olson. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Have a nice night.
And we'll go directly to another, 312-591-7200. Jerry is next up. Good evening.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, sir. Go ahead.
I'll preface by stating that I was never in a public school growing up. I grew up in parochial school system. So everything I know is basically secondhand. But what is Mr. Olson's view and opinion on students, in spite of what they're taught that may be biased from a left or right-wing viewpoint, taking it upon themselves to go out and, you know, find out for their own opinions and read up on other books and authors outside of the classroom?
I think that's a very good thing. I mean, frankly, I don't think education should ever stop. But I feel, though, is that with our public education system, that's what they should be getting in the classroom. I mean, that's what we're paying for. That's what we're sending our kids to go to school to learn, and that should be happening in the classroom. But unfortunately, like the student just said, a lot of time class time is being filled up with other things. But I don't think learning should ever stop.
That's very good. I appreciate your taking my call.
Thank you, sir, for the call. Here's an interesting little email. I teach American history now as a substitute teacher. I have been in classrooms where some of the regular teachers have posters and bumper stickers proselytizing their personal and political agendas. Whatever happened to the teacher's license boundaries? I believe these teachers believe that their political agendas trump ethics. Signed, a Wisconsin listener.
Unfortunately, I think that's right. And what we've seen in a lot of states is with tenure and with seniority and other HR policies that we have in our public schools, there's very little that can be done because you may have someone pushing that type of philosophy, but you can't necessarily get them out of the system, which I think is a problem.
And quickly, another caller. This is Don who joins us. Good evening. You're on the air. Hello. Are you there, sir?
This is Tom.
Well, then I got the wrong name, but I'm glad that you're here.
Okay. I would like to wonder if the young man who just called, the high school student, don't these schools have curriculum guides? Doesn't anybody enforce what's supposed to be taught? And the second thing I'd like to say, as a former administrator, I worked a lot with student teachers. And I always had them read a book called Teaching as a Subversive Activity. The thesis of this book is that the main job of a teacher is to help students to learn how to think. Not think along anybody's specific lines, but how to think, how to hypothesize, how to problem solve. And a very good book, and every teacher that ever read it enjoyed it and thanked me for recommending it. I don't remember the name of the author at the moment, but a very interesting book.
I haven't heard that book, but I wish that was the environment that more students were in, where go ahead.
No curriculum guides in these schools? Doesn't anybody ask what is going on in the classroom?
Well,
as an administrator, now I was in a Catholic school, but I walked around every day and I'd stop in classes several times a week and just stand there for 5 minutes and listen. Mm-hmm. And if something was going on that I didn't think was part of the curriculum, I'd question the teacher on it.
Well, you would have to ask public school administrators if they do that. But what I have found is that the states will pass requirements that students have to have, you know, X number of hours of math and that sort of thing. But what actually is going on to meet those requirements is largely up to the teacher and the school leadership. And so that's where we see – we talked about social justice math earlier – that's where we see these types of problems, story problems, and those types of things working their way in. So they're still meeting the requirements of kids learning math, but the question is how is it being accomplished? And so that's where sometimes the teacher's personal political agenda works its way in.
And we thank you for the call, sir. We have to move rather quickly. Time is rather short at the moment. And next up is, I don't know. Next up is Roger, and you are on the air, sir.
Yeah, good evening. Milt, I'd just like to take a little bit issue with your guest tonight. You know, rather than indicting a political party for education that's failing, what they say, maybe 85% dysfunctionalism in our culture today, and families, and it's growing. Parents don't even go to parent-teacher conferences. You got a parents that shouldn't be parents or don't realize what their role in life truly is, maybe they ought to be graded. The reason why is I have two daughters that are educators, and I frequently talk with them, and it's a growing problem. Parents refuse to get involved in the educational system. Granted, I really think we ought to take the politics out of education, but we need to get parents involved in their child's education. After all, they brought this child into the world. And they are responsible until they graduate from higher education or what degree they feel that they want to go on in life. I think this has to be addressed. Very often when you get the educational talks like this, it's almost like talking about religion and politics. And no one ever puts, or very, very rarely puts, the parents or it tries to indict the parents as far as, listen, you got to take control of your children. This is part of your life. This is part of your role in life. And I'll listen to your guest.
Sure, I agree. Parents ultimately need to own the education of their child. And I think far too often what has happened is parents have just simply turned their kids over to a school, and they assume that education process is actually being accomplished. But oftentimes what they end up finding out is that their child is not learning the things that they need to learn. They're not learning how to read. They're not learning basic math. They're not becoming, you know, contributors to society. And so,
may I mention one more thing too?
Sure.
Okay, I'm Catholic. The pews are getting a little bit. There's a lot of empty pews in Catholic churches today. Most parents today. I'm not talking about solely Catholicism. I'm talking about Judaism, whatever. They're not. These are the realms they should be teaching, as far as creationism and things like this. If your guest Milt says that we shouldn't be teaching about creationism in school, yeah, we shouldn't be teaching about that, like in Texas. But that is not their realm. Then let them go to CCD or Bible classes or Torah classes and learn about these things there. Or if you're Islamic, learn from your Islamic religion class. That is the realm of religion. Perhaps we ought to be taking religion out of the schools and not even touching it.
Sir, you have given the final major point in our conversation tonight. There's time only for a quick response from Kyle Olson.
To me, the bottom line is parents have got to own the education of their children. And I know I just said that, but I don't think it can be said enough. And so parents are ultimately responsible for that. They need to go to parent-teacher conferences. They need to check homework. They need to do those things and make sure that their child is successful.
Now, my son graduated from college over 20 years ago. Am I still, in some sense, obliged to foster, to contribute to his further education?
Sure.
Yeah?
Absolutely.
That's what I tell him, but he doesn't necessarily agree.
I don't think it should ever stop. The world is changing. I mean, we were talking about technology earlier. The world is changing, and we should never stop learning.
But there comes a point when, for older folks like me, the children, sometimes even the grandchildren, can be good sources of education and enlightenment for the grandfather.
It's amazing what little kids can teach their grandparents and parents about technology.
My grandson has been working assiduously on calculus, and it's beyond me.
Mm-hmm.
When he talks to me about calculus, I just grunt in approval, but he doesn't know how little I know.
And see, to me, this is the crime of dumbing down the standards, is that kids are incredible, and they when you set expectations high and you set accountability high, they will achieve.
With that, we have come to the end of the available time. Kyle Olson has been our guest. Indoctrination is the title of his new book. And we will be back tomorrow night just for the second hour, that is 11 to midnight, after a hockey game. And we'll see you then. 11 o'clock tomorrow night. Until then, thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial good night.